Hello and welcome to the Majlis Radio for Republic of Liberty's current affairs podcast focusing on Central Asia. I'm Mohammed Tahir, Radio for Republic of Liberty's media manager and host of the Majlis podcast here in Washington, D.C. January 24 is a special day for lawyers and attorneys. This day is marked as the International Day of Endangered Lawyers. The topic couldn't be more pressing and more relevant to lawyers and members of the legal community in Central Asia, where law and legal practices are in trouble on so many levels, where lawyers often find themselves in the hot water just for doing what they're supposed to do, which is to defend the defenseless. In some cases, those who come to defense of the arrested lawyers are also arrested for defending the lawyer. In some other cases, judges are threatened, attacked just for taking wrong type of decisions. In the meantime, there are a growing number of untouchable personalities and there are institutions which remains beyond the reach of lawyers. So in simple terms, this is one of those professions in Central Asia that is full of challenges and difficulties. And today we are here to listen to lawyers who are in the field despite all these challenges and learn how does it look like to be a lawyer in Central Asia in such an environment? What are the risks? What puts one in trouble? And how they navigate these challenges? And more importantly, why they keep doing what they're doing despite all these risks? To discuss all these, I'm joined by Madina Akhmetova, the director of public association Dignity, based in Nur Sultan, Kazakhstan. Steve Severlo, human rights lawyer and associate professor of human rights at the University of Southern California. Steve has just came back from Tashkent. Jasmine Cameron, senior staff attorney at the American Bar Association, who leads the center's projects on Central Asia. Jasmine is originally from Kyrgyzstan. Bruce Panier, the editor of Radio Free Liberty Central Asia blog, Kishlok Owazi. Thank you, colleagues, for joining us. So I don't know if the congratulation is the right word as you and as we mark the International Day of Endangered Lawyers. One would wish that we never had to mark this day in these terms, but this is the reality of current times. So thank you for doing God's work, colleagues. Jasmine, we spoke about this day in the context of your work in Central Asia offline. And let me say this, you are one of those I really admire. You deserve lots of appreciation for your terrific work on defending your fellow attorneys in Central Asia and always on the top of your work. Likewise, over all the other speakers on the panel, Steve and Madina. Thank you very much, colleagues, for doing what you are doing. So let's start this with the sort of a general question, Jasmine. Why is this day and the topic is important and relevant to today's Central Asia?
Thank you so much for having me here. It's a really important conversation to talk about lawyers. We have the International Day of the Endangered Lawyers now. It's been celebrated 11th year, and usually they have a focus country every year. This year, the focus country is Azerbaijan, but it's still really, really important to talk about lawyers everywhere else, especially in Central Asia. And it's so important because lawyers play such a fundamental role in any democratic society. Lawyers facilitate the administration of justice, lawyers guarantee access to justice, and of course, they work on upholding human rights and the rule of law. Just to be clear that I work at the Center for Human Rights at the American Bar Association, and we focus specifically on providing technical assistance to lawyers at risk. And I understand that in the last several years in Kyrgyzstan, in Central Asia in general, there have been very negative trends, unfortunately, where lawyers becoming more and more subjects of increased harassment, pressure as a result of their work. And unfortunately, we've seen such pressure and intimidation from both the state and non-state actors. Obviously, when we have cases where the main perpetrators are state actors, these cases mostly focus on lawyers working on sensitive political cases. But there are unfortunately a lot of cases where perpetrators are simple members of the community and possibly members of family of the opposing side. And unfortunately, it takes place in practice where we've seen such cases. And I'm happy to talk later about the reasons why it happens. But what's important to understand is that this conversation is difficult because in the last 10 or so years, this trend has been increasing, where governments put more pressure on the lawyers as a result of their work, and lawyers need more and more protection, not only as individuals, but also as professionals.
Right. Maybe, Jasmine, we could just go into those some of those details. I mean, you mentioned like threats that lawyers are receiving or the members of the legal communities are receiving. I mean, how, in which form those threats would come?
Well, usually threats come in various forms. Mm. When we have governments as main actors that are violating lawyers' rights, governments very often using different techniques. It could be general slander or defamation. It could be procedural norms that they're using. For example, they call lawyers as witnesses. It could be, in some cases, not very common in Central Asia, but we've seen many cases in other countries where government, through Ministry of Justice, they disbar lawyers. Mm. For example, in Azerbaijan or Belarus, we haven't seen that many cases like that in Central Asia. And also, I want to bring an example of Kyrgyzstan, mm. where unfortunately there were many cases brought up to the public attention in the last couple of years. For example, the local bar association wrote an open letter to the president of the country 2 years ago stating that there were several instances where government openly was attacking lawyers. Mm. And those lawyers were working on sensitive political cases. Mm. Government, for example, issued press releases indicating that lawyers were not following the procedures. But in reality, it was a tactic of a government saying that the lawyers are, not doing their work. And by that, they're already sort of creating stigma and creating barriers and problems for lawyers to fulfill their professional duties.
Right. Steve Severlo, previously as the Central Asia researcher for Human Rights Watch, and you have monitored these cases for so long as I remember. And of course, there are countries might vary from each other in terms of the pressure on lawyers. So looking into, let's say, Uzbekistan and Tajikistan, how much does the comments by Jasmine resonates when you look into those two countries? Or maybe perhaps Turkmenistan in this case.
And as Jasmine says, when it comes to Central Asia, it's been a very systematic crackdown on the independence of the legal profession, and more specifically on the criminal defense bar in many cases across this region. And I would agree that it's a trend that we've been watching for a long time, about 10 years, as Jasmine says. 10 years, for example, a little bit more than 10 years ago, marked the introduction of a law in Uzbekistan, which basically abolished the legal profession as an independent entity, placing it under the control of the Ministry of Justice. And then that later was repeated in Tajikistan, and we've seen very similar efforts underway in Kazakhstan, and of course Turkmenistan's a completely other case. But as Jasmine said, we've got the violations really span a large spectrum, of course beginning in the most serious cases with the imprisonment of lawyers in Central Asia. And of course, in that regard, in that category, Tajikistan really takes our attention, because we now have, according to my count, at least three lawyers imprisoned, and Bruce has written recently about the most recent imprisonment of Said Nuruddin Shamsidinov, who got 8.5 years on various fraud-related charges that appear trumped up and in retaliation for his work. Of course, we know the case of Buzurgmer Yorov, imprisoned for 28 years and detained back in 2015. And then the lawyer that defended him was imprisoned. Nuruddin Mahkamov got 21 years. Also in Tajikistan, we have Abdulaziz Abdurrahman Zodah, who was tortured, and even the chairperson of lawyers, Said Bek Nuruddinov, was intimidated back in 2019. We did, just to make sure we think of the individuals that have suffered here in recent years, as Jasmine said, we have seen a few disbarments, not as many, but we saw disbarments of lawyers in Tajikistan and travel bans on the late Faizin Yusufahidova. Moving to Uzbekistan, we saw a few disbarments at that period when those laws were introduced. And then, of course, after Tajikistan, in terms of imprisonment, we've seen the arrest and imprisonment of Peygamberli Alaberdiyev in September 2020, who was actually not a human rights lawyer, but a lawyer working for a government agency on oil and gas, who was accused of having ties, potential ties, with opposition activists abroad, and was in a sort of typical case, was sort of caught up in a sort of provocation on the street, a sort of street fight that appeared to be orchestrated by authorities, mm-hmm. was arrested and got prison time in his own prison. And then, of course, we've seen in a very, very high-profile case, a lot of us know of the really courageous lawyer Ayman Umarova in Kazakhstan, whose pet was actually killed as a form of intimidation when she was working on a high-profile case of defending an Uyghur refugee from Xinjiang that had come to Kazakhstan and sought refugee status. So we've got a really, really severe situation of persecution of lawyers, which we should mention violates the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights that all these five nations have signed, and the UN Basic Principles on the Role of Lawyers. And we can speak a little bit later about efforts to reform those in Uzbekistan and where those reform efforts have stalled.
Right. Oh, certainly we will. Thank you, Steve. Medina, you know, Steve mentioned a couple of cases from Kazakhstan, and you are there on the ground, and we are hearing lots of negative news coming out of Kazakhstan these days that involves, of course, NGOs and independent journalists who are based in Kazakhstan, and certainly the legal community there. I mean, you are working as part of the organization which tries to defend lawyers and human rights activists here. So what would put lawyers in trouble?
Yes, right. Lawyers are not protected in Kazakhstan now. We, as an organization who are focused on human rights defenders and civic activists' protection and security, we provide a monitoring on human rights defenders and civic activists' protection. And lawyers are considered as one of the seven categories of human rights defenders that have been subjected to a greater degree of threats since 2017. 100 lawyers have been threatened in the last 9 years. There are 36 women and 64 men. And the largest number of threats was in 2017. We have a lot of cases when lawyers are under the attack by provocateurs. Revocation of lawyers' license exists. Now we have at least 3 cases that shows us those violations in relation to lawyers. Police and the court, they are acting as the sources of those threats. That is the common point, not only about lawyers, but the other categories of human rights defenders.
These are very useful points that you are raising, Medina. But I also just wondered as to when or maybe in which types of situations lawyers could get more in trouble. I mean, is there any specific sector which is sort of off limit for lawyers, where if they intervene, gets in trouble? I'm just trying to ask my question without making any outrageous political mistake here. So I guess my question is whether there are any boundaries that lawyers are expected to stay in. Once they step out, they are punished. What are the scenarios in which lawyers gets in trouble?
Yes, we have, for example, in instance, we have the cases. We have the lawyer Gulshat Jusenova. She is a lawyer here in Nur Sultan, and she represents and defends the interest of civil activists who are under the Article 405 of Criminal Code. So that Article of Criminal Code is about the participation in political organizations that were banned by the decision of court. So when she started to work with those civic activists, she started face some attacks on her. For example, there was some situations when she was really attacked. So she was beaten by the provocateur in the police department. And all of this situation, it was filmed on the video by the just individuals and the police officers that were in that department. But nothing was taken against those provocateurs.
Right.
It's not just only her. As as was mentioned, we have another Ayman Umarova. That's right. She was her car was set on fire. Her dog was killed in the courtyard of her house. And we have another three cases of lawyers who were like active in their lawyers' activity. Kashiga Kushkinov, he was tortured for 12 hours in the building of the anti-corruption service in the Mangustau region for the purpose. He was forced to participate in giving a bribe to a city court judge. He was the Kushkinov where he defended the victim in the case of torture. It was a kid. At the time he was 20 years old and he lost his kidney. There are a lot of cases that show us that the threats against lawyers exist.
Right. Bruce, let me also bring you in earlier. Steve referred to your recent story, and certainly I went through that. It's an excellent piece that I recommend everyone to go and read while listening to the podcast. In Kazakhstan, Bruce, as we discussed this in the past, defending Uyghur activists has kind of become a sensitive issue, I guess, lately in Kazakhstan, as well as defending those young activists on the ground who are demanding reform in the country. If there's anything you could add in on that, please do. And also, Turkmenistan is a kind of a dark space in this discussion, but we shouldn't let this skip from our radar. Earlier, Medina mentioned lawyers could face pressure from the authorities just because of defending someone. But in Turkmenistan, you cannot even find a lawyer to defend something that authorities don't like. But in our case, for instance, we have contributors on the ground. When they get in trouble, you don't find any lawyer even to pick up that case. What's your observation from Turkmenistan? Also, any other area that you would like to add into this?
Kazakhstan and the Uyghurs, there's a kind of a difference in how much publicity the case gets, right? And it's certainly the early cases, when they did get a lot of publicity, their lawyers, although they, and Medina would know better, but I mean, they didn't face quite so many, I don't remember them facing quite so many difficulties. Saira Gul, for instance, her lawyers seem, because it was getting so much publicity, they didn't really bother them so much. But it's lately because, of course, they're trying to, every time one of these ethnic Kazakhs or something, one of the ethnic Kazakhs from Xinjiang makes it into Kazakhstan, they're trying to keep it quieter and quieter all the time, right? You don't see as much publicity. And I know there's a lot of stuff going on in the world anyway, but, I haven't seen as much publicity except for, recently two of them were beaten on the same day, which also shows how much out of the public spotlight it is now compared to a couple of years ago when the first ethnic Kazakhs cases were being raised. So that's something. Turkmenistan, what can you say about Turkmenistan? I don't blame it. Nepis Kuliyev, I think their family did actually, he was working for us, and I think they actually did get an attorney to defend him that wasn't the state prosecutors, the state appointed attorney. But Turkmenistan obviously is the extreme. I mean, I can remember during the Azov's time, and I think it was they had state appointed attorneys for the people who were allegedly involved in trying to assassinate Niyazov. And some of them began these are the defendants, right? Their clients are the ones that are being accused of all this stuff. And their lawyers would get up and start their speech by saying, "It's a great disgrace for me to have to defend a person like this." You can figure that you're done when that's your attorney is supposed to be defending you. And that's how he starts the case.
Like a Stalinist show trial, like a Stalinist show trial.
Yeah, exactly. It's just horrible that, in Turkmenistan, again, it's like the greatest example of what a sham these governments can put it to, because they will give you an attorney because it says that, according to their constitution and their laws, they have to give you an attorney, but most everyone knows that the defendant's going to be guilty. The attorney's not, it really isn't going to do anything to change that. I mean, there's a deal. Like Steve said, it's almost like the Stalinist times. The prosecutor and the attorney have already got this, and all the attorneys involved have already got this thing worked out. That defendant's going to be guilty, and this is what the sentence is going to be. So, it's really hopeless. If you get in trouble in Turkmenistan, I said you'll get legal representation, but not adequate legal representation.
You will get someone provided by the authorities, and again, the type of legal aid you will get from the government-appointed lawyer in Turkmenistan, again, I don't know whether it's helpful or I don't know.
Well, like I said, when they essentially start by saying, "I don't even want to defend this loser,"
yeah.
it kind of says it all about the court system.
Yeah.
If I can add a little bit about Turkmenistan and its true, their dark area in terms of legal representation, as far as we know, there are about just 400 lawyers that are allowed to practice as lawyers for the country of 6 million people. If math proves they're right, it's about one lawyer per, 17,000 people, right? So by itself, it creates the barrier to legal representation. In our work, we get the exposure to getting more information about how legal profession functions is through providing assistance to human rights defenders. And exactly as Bruce said, is that, for example, we are working on the case of Mansur Mingelov, a human rights defender in Turkmenistan. And what we've seen through his case is that his case and his fair trial rights were totally violated exactly through the lack of legal representation. He was allowed to, by the government, he was appointed a lawyer, and the family tried to find another lawyer. But as you said, that lawyers there are so afraid of taking sensitive cases that it just defeats the whole purpose, that there is no effective legal representation. And it's interesting because their trials usually last for 10 or 15 minutes. So from the very beginning, we know the outcome of the case. For the defenders, there is no access to the lawyer. For example, Mansur Mingelov, he's seen his lawyer just twice throughout the trial. He did not have access to documentation. He did not have access to his file case, so he was not able to appeal. And international community, the UN bodies, they do realize what a difficult situation it is. And so when they get just the example of dysfunction legal system in Turkmenistan is that when there are petitions going to UN Human Rights Committee, for example, cases from Turkmenistan sometimes get waiver on the condition that the legal internal mechanism exhaustion is not possible because the legal system does not allow for that, that it's not working in the sense that we understand it. So just as Bruce mentioned, that it's a very, very difficult situation in Turkmenistan,
On that, Jasmine, I'm sure you, you mentioned a couple of cases from there. Yeah, we understand the situation, the legal practices in Turkmenistan, the limitations there. I mean, in case of Mengele, for instance, if you would like to send a lawyer from, let's say, from, I don't know, from other country, from Russia, from Europe somewhere, is it possible to send a lawyer to defend those local cases in local courts?
No, it's not possible, because in order to practice in local jurisdiction, you need to have a license. And usually, as Steve mentioned, that the concept of independence of legal profession is really, really important. So what we've seen in basically all of the countries in Central Asia, Kyrgyzstan might be a little bit of an exception, where legal profession is trying to be independent, but the key is that lawyers and the bar association, they have to be independent from the executive. But unfortunately, the main two aspects of independence of legal profession is the access to the legal profession and also the discipline, right? So who has the access or who has the leverage in terms of allowing lawyers to practice? It's Ministry of Justice. And as much as the legal profession is trying to establish itself as independent, it's really, really hard. It's sort of legacy from the Soviet time where a legal profession was just a part of Ministry of Justice. Now I understand that countries like Kyrgyzstan, they deserve a credit. They've been working on their law for a long time. They have a new law that they adopted several years ago, and their bar association is trying to be independent. But of course, there are a lot of problems on the road to that. For example, they don't have financial independence for the bar association, that they're still dependent on the government budget. That's why it's really hard for them to take that function back to themselves, because there are a lot of reasons. For example, lawyers still do not understand the concept of the membership fees, right? They, like in Kyrgyzstan, they believe that they shouldn't pay bar fees, but what they don't understand that those bar fees actually would allow for the bar association to be self-sufficient, to be independent, because bar association, they have a huge role in the independent, in sort of the concept of independence of legal profession. Bar associations, they're supposed to protect lawyers.
Right. Yeah. On that, Steve, let me bring you in here. Like, we need to move on, really. There are some other points that we have to discuss before the end of the conversation. You worked very closely with the some opposition cases in Tajikistan. And that's why I think you might help us to understand certain things like there in Tajikistan. Of course, being a member of the Islamic Party there already puts you in trouble. And then if anyone comes in defense of you, and I'm talking about lawyers, they also get in trouble. In situation like this, what is the solution then? I mean, Jasmine earlier said that we cannot send lawyers from outside, even to monitor what's happening, not let alone provide help. So what we are left with in situation like this? I mean, where the solution lies then? I mean, are we going to, I don't know, whether Central Asian countries, all of them at least, are member of any international body through which you could channelize these kind of legal cases, like, I don't know, European Human Rights Court? I guess none of Central Asians will accept any, I don't know, maybe they do. I'm just really illiterate in these legal terms there. So what are the options we left with in a situation like this?
Yeah, no, thanks, Mohammed. I mean, you laid it out very well, and Jasmine just very eloquently described so many of the limitations. And, you know, I think it's important to recognize that often these issues of the structure or the restrictions on the independence of lawyers in the legal profession, this is sort of a less, if I may say, that's a less sexy, sometimes less dramatic issue that just doesn't get covered as much as the attacks on human rights defenders or journalists that are being imprisoned and other attacks on civil society, which we're often taken up with. But I think, as you stated, and why this program is so important, is that without a system that is independent, without a legal profession that is a separate entity from the state, then sort of all other rights flow from the right to a fair trial, the right to legal representation. And we mentioned that all of these countries are signatories of the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. They voluntarily signed up to this treaty, which guarantees the right to a fair trial and to counsel of one's choice. And so, of course, as Jasmine also earlier mentioned, there are remedies for individuals to take their cases all the way to the Human Rights Committee to file cases. Of course, it's very hard to enforce those. You mentioned in your question, Mohammed, whether or not cases could be taken to the European Court of Human Rights. Sadly, that's one of the areas where Central Asia just sits outside of these effective systems because they are not under the jurisdiction of the European Court of Human Rights, although sometimes we see these issues being raised at the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. But, you know, there are other mechanisms. There's the UN Special Rapporteur on the Independence of Lawyers and Judges, who is the world roaming expert, you could say, who takes country visits to look at this specific issue of the independence of lawyers and intimidations, threats, imprisonment of lawyers. And while he has not visited Tajikistan or Turkmenistan and the rest of the region, he has recently been in Uzbekistan in September 2019. He issued several recommendations on the need to reform the system, and we saw President Mirziyoyev at least making some signs that there would be a new code adopted and additional measures taken to change the law from 2009. Sadly, that hasn't happened yet. It's stalled. I think also we need to see the U.S. government, the European Union, raising, obviously, first and foremost, the need to free imprisoned lawyers like Buzurgmir Yorov, Nuruddin Mahkamov. Yorov got coronavirus in the last year. And so these cases need to be publicly raised. And there need to be, of course, a discussion of real consequences for not just the individual cases, but the systematic crackdown on lawyers, which is, as we've been discussing, has such a long and deep running effect on civil society.
Right. Yeah. Thank you very much, Steve. I got a little bit distracted from our original topic, which is supposed to be challenges of being a lawyer in Central Asia. So on that, is this challenge deteriorating in or getting better in some cases in Central Asia? I heard some of you saying that trajectory is generally on negative direction. But I also heard some thoughts about Uzbekistan. Maybe some reforms are taking place there. So was there any kind of a tipping point in which really led the region into the direction that we are talking about, which is in many cases complicated? Is there anything can be done about this situation? So let's continue talking about these and many other questions very shortly. ¶¶ First, let me recap the debate. Today on the Majlis podcast, I'm joined by Madina Ahmedova, the director of public association Dignity based in Nur Sultan. Steve Severlu, human rights lawyer and associate professor of human rights at the University of Southern California. Jasmine Cameron, senior staff attorney at the Human Rights Center of the American Bar Association. Bruce Panier, the editor of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, Central Asia blog, Kishlok Awazi. And I'm Mohammed Tahir, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's media manager and host of the Majlis podcast here in Washington, D.C. And we are discussing the challenges of being a lawyer in Central Asia. So let me begin right from there where I ended. We discussed about negative trajectory. Is there anything you could think of which could be described as a tipping point which led the region into this direction? Bruce, let's start with you.
You know, I think it's going to be different in every country. You know, as a Turkmenistan never had, to begin with, any kind of independent judiciary or created the opportunities for, you know, truly independent lawyers to practice in the country. You know, they run into problems at different times, I think, because part of the reason is I think the leadership has a hard time, at least did have a hard time understanding that their word alone wasn't taken as the law, right? Okay, everyone has their laws and they have a constitution and a criminal code and all that kind of stuff. But the leadership in a lot of these countries figured that for some reason that, you know, that was just for show. But when high profile cases would show up and all of a sudden these independent lawyers would show up and they did know the law, you know, and so they would say, you can't put my client in jail because here's, you know, this reason, this is in the criminal code, this is in the criminal code, this is in the criminal code. So the government's resorted to, you know, fixing the game, so to speak, all of a sudden, faced with evidence from defense attorneys that they couldn't refute fairly, you know, or logically in a court of law. They resorted to all kinds of other things to pressure the attorneys themselves into not taking the case. It's almost saying you're too clever for me, so we're not going to accept a bunch of stuff. Now, you know, you mentioned how things changed a little bit. Well, in Uzbekistan, it's not exactly the lawyers, but they did finally change the rule that you couldn't be convicted for evidence, you know, for confessions that you'd made under torture, right? But in all the countries, this has always been a problem. So the prosecuting attorney says the guy confessed. Here's the confession. You know, he's got it written or he's, you know, with the defendant's signature, or it's been videotaped, and in fact, the poor person was beaten, you know, into making this confession. So at least the Uzbek system, publicly anyway, recognizes that should never be accepted as evidence in a court of law. But it is accepted in a lot, you know, in the other countries, and probably still it would be in Uzbekistan. They don't, and when the defending lawyer says this confession was coerced under torture, but the judges won't accept that. They won't accept expert testimony that defense lawyers try to bring up either, you know. So like I said, it's really weird that the state just all of a sudden decided that if they couldn't win the game fairly, they weren't going to let anybody that could play for the other team play at all.
Yeah, on that, maybe, Medina, you could also talk about the case in Kazakhstan. You know, in Kazakhstan, things have been better compared to many of its neighbors, like, which is still better, you know, when you compare the country with Tajikistan and in Turkmenistan, for instance. But you also talk about an increasing pressure on lawyers, for instance. Could you think of any specific time, year, maybe month, or maybe a situation which can be described as the tipping point which led to this trajectory?
The fact that lawyers in Kazakhstan, they became a bit more active and they stopped being silent about some things in legislation or in the practice, and the lawyers, they start to work with human rights defenders and civil activists, that the positive fact that I want to mention for lawyers. But the other side of that situation is that maybe government doesn't like that fact. We have the cases is a lot, and I wanted to add to what Steve talked about. We have the case of a lawyer who take her case to the UN Human Rights Committee, and the decision was made in her favor. That was Zinaida Mukhortova, the lawyer from Balkhar. She spent a year and a half in a psychiatric hospital in custody because she complained to the president about law enforcement interference in the cases. So, and in the conclusion observations of the Committee Against Torture, an entire section is devoted to that lawyer. What I...
On the tipping point, I'm just trying to understand the cause that might have contributed to all these negative trends that the type of trajectory you are talking about today in Kazakhstan. You know, Kazakhstan wasn't always as depressing as it might seem today when you look at the situation from certain perspectives. So was there any event, situation, date and time which might have prompted all these changes in Kazakhstan?
As I mentioned before, that in 2017...
Okay. So what you said 2017, what led to that?
It is related to the civic society. From that year, the civic society became more active. I mean, the protests, the meetings. That's why that year, 2017, is the, the start point of those threats to the civic activists and for the lawyers themselves.
Thank you very much, Medina. So, you know, there are lots of negativity in the conversation, of course, rightly, because there are trends that needs to be talked about. Is there any positive example that we could share, we could talk about today? I mean, when I say positive, I see Uzbek authorities coming to Washington, D.C., bragging about changes that they are making, sea changes, they say, are happening in Uzbekistan. Is there anything like that happening in the legal framework, Steve? What's going on there?
Well, as I said, it was a big deal that the government invited and accepted the visit of a UN special rapporteur, who they gave access to meet with lawyers, including those under pressure. He made a number of recommendations. And of course, when he finished his visit, he praised certain changes in the area of the judiciary. There was a judicial council that was created that put a little bit more distance between the president appointing judges, and now it's done by a council. There's still, you know, the hand of the executive is still very much involved in the judiciary, but less so than under Karima. So that was praise. But when it comes to the legal profession, the UN Special Rapporteur very clearly said that the legal profession has to be independent. And in fact, the law as it stands currently, it's still remains relatively unchanged from the Karima period, which actually prohibits, it bans all other legal bar associations from even existing. So think about that. That's a monopoly on lawyers. And as I think Jasmine or someone else might have said, it's hard to differentiate at some point the legal profession or the bar association, as we call it, from the Ministry of Justice. I would call many of these bar associations across Central Asia as sort of quasi-ministries of justice. And so the UN Special Rapporteur clearly pointed out that needs to change. And when I was in Uzbekistan, I met with a number of lawyers that, you know, Bruce was just saying that there have been steps taken to declare that torture evidence collected through the use of torture should be inadmissible in court. But unfortunately, many lawyers told me that torture is still obviously regularly practiced, but also admitted into court, used as evidence. And some of them had described that over the past year, I guess you could say this is a positive step, that lawyers have organized themselves, they have formed recommendations and a working group to make recommendations on making the legal profession more independent. But as they've told me, this is really stalled. So I think early in 2020, we saw these recommendations introduced from civil society and lawyers. And for some reason, we haven't seen the president take those things up. And that's very similar, unfortunately, to a number of other key legal reforms and human rights reforms that have been asked for. A new code on civil society and NGOs, more independence for other areas of civil society and religious groups. So I think a lot of these things in rhetoric and in some statements, we have seen positive signs, but we need to see much more action than we have.
Right.
And one more point I just add is Bruce also mentioned all these different tricks that are used to deny clients access to their lawyers. We also see an increasing use. I don't know, I haven't done a study of this statistically, but across Tajikistan, certainly, we've seen increasing use of this grif sekretnosti, this confidential or classified stamp that is placed on cases, gag orders that prevent lawyers from speaking about cases. We see that used all the time in Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, Turkmenistan, other parts of Central Asia. And so I think all of these things, again,
right? What does it do, Steve?
The gag order essentially makes it impossible for journalists and the public and even relatives to find out what's happening to defendants. And you held a program about a year ago or less on espionage cases in Uzbekistan. Oh, yeah. And there we've seen a concentration of torture of the clients and an inability of lawyers to speak about those cases openly.
It's a very, very important discussion that we are having today. But in the meantime, we also need to wrap up very soon. We are already way over time. Maybe last word. word should go to you, Jasmine. So yes, it's a difficult time that Central Asia is going through, lots of challenges. To your colleagues on the ground who are in the business of law and defending people, so is there anything can be done about it? I mean, is there any way this trajectory can be stopped and put in the right direction?
Absolutely. There are several ways where we all can provide assistance for the local lawyers. And local lawyers obviously play a major role in improving the situation on the ground. For local lawyers, it's really important to continue to advocate and explain their role in society, because one of the main causes, what actually causes such situation, is the very low level of legal culture, low level of respect of rule of law. That's why you have those lots of cases from Kyrgyzstan. You have low level of prosecutors, investigators that simply violating rights of lawyers. They're not letting lawyers to see their clients. They're issuing different types of bureaucratic sort of creating problems for the lawyers to function successfully. For the international community, it's really important to show solidarity, and we've seen on the ground that it really works in the cases in Kyrgyzstan when the civil society was advocating for several lawyers, for example, Sergei Slesarenko, Zamir Joshev, Nurbek Toktakunov, and others, also Kamil Ruzi, who is not attorney but lawyer, minority lawyer living in a region in Kyrgyzstan, who is also a human rights defender. It's really important for legal community to remind local governments and non-state actors that those international standards are important to follow, not only for the sake of it, but also to ensure that the people and the government also protect it, because it's a sort of the circular argument, right? One day you were talking about tipping point when usually such problem occurs, is that usually they're very, very closely tied up to political events, right? After elections, you have lots of cases against opposition members. And who represents them? Lawyers.
Right.
So, and then it all changes, the cycle changes, and then you find situation where other players, political players, need representation.
Right.
So it's really important for Bar Association to realize their role, the important role that they play in protecting lawyers. It's also people have to understand that lawyers are so important in the function of any democratic society.
Right. Thank you, Jasmine. Steve, we are really out of time. We need to end the conversation as soon as we can. I'm just trying to end this painful discussion that we had today, at least on a hope that we can hold on. Steve, what comes to my mind is countries in Central Asia, at least Kazakhstan, used to hold positions on international committees. I guess currently is holding some sort of directorship role at the OSCE. So, I mean, these types of international exposures also provides an opportunity to make these countries accountable. Do we have any opportunity like this as we speak?
Well, I think Jasmine laid out a number of important suggestions that, you know, we have to stick up for the Bar Association. It's not always the issue. It's at the top of mind in terms of human rights priorities or international negotiations. But it's absolutely essential, because who else do we have? If we don't have independent lawyers, we really have no other rights. And I think that your question, though, Mohammed, gets at, I think, maybe the appointment of Uzbekistan more recently as a member of the UN Human Rights Council, which a lot of people have paid attention to. Of course, it's quite an extraordinary development for a Central Asian nation to be on, to have membership, and one that has had such a recent reputation of being repressive and is now struggling to throw off that image. And I think that places a higher burden, of course, on Uzbekistan to move forward with reforms, allow a legal profession that will be independent. But I think more broadly, when it comes to the crackdown on lawyers, the silencing of lawyers, the chilling effect on lawyers that we've seen across Central Asia, we want to have not just UN bodies granted access and the UN special rapporteur allowed to visit all of these countries immediately, but we need to see resolutions, declarations, human rights reports like the kind that the State Department is actually writing now on Central Asia. We're expecting that report in a few months' time. I hope that those signs of concern will be voiced very loudly. I'm hoping the Biden administration will prioritize lawyers in addition to other civil society activists' rights. And also, again, we sometimes have to talk about the toughest forms of consequences. Targeted sanctions are sometimes necessary in these cases. And I think certainly when it comes to the imprisonment of lawyers in Turkmenistan and Tajikistan currently, there need to be serious discussions that the prosecutors and the judges and the higher level officials involved, the security services that are involved in arresting lawyers and keeping them in prison and sometimes torturing them, should be subject to visa denials and freezes of their assets so that we stop seeing this crackdown.
I think
absolutely. If I can just add one more thing, is that it's really important to continue to talk about this problem, and that on the larger issues, that human rights agenda on any level should be part of the discussion. As part of human rights agenda, lawyers' rights should be always highlighted. Sadly, it's not always, as Steve said, it's not a sexy topic as imprisoned journalists or human rights defenders, but it's very, very much important and needed topic to continue to talk about.
Right. Thank you very much. With this, I think we should conclude the discussion right here. Thank you very much, Jasmine Cameron, Senior Staff Attorney at the Center for Human Rights of the American Bar Association. And also big thanks goes to Steve Savarlu, Human Rights Lawyer and Associate Professor of Human Rights at the University of Southern California, Medina Akhmetova, the Director of the Public Association Dignity, based out of Nur Sultan, Kazakhstan, and Bruce Panier, the Editor of Radio Free Europe, the Liberty Center Central Asia blog, Kishlok Awazi. Again, thank you very much, colleagues, for your time and thoughts today. And this is it from me, Mohammed Tahir, Radio Free Europe, Liberty's media manager and host of the Majlis podcast here in Washington. Until next week, bye-bye.